The presenting sponsor of Top Docs is Netflix. Now presenting the documentary series, Escaping Twin Flames. From Emmy nominee Cecilia Peck, this three-part documentary series pulls back the veil on Twin Flames universe, a controversial online community that preys on people looking for love. Den of Geek says it tackles one of the more interesting subjects that streaming has in some time. Escaping Twin Flames is available now on Netflix.
Anxious Nation explores the epidemic of anxiety in our country, especially its impact among our youth and their families. And it also explores ways to repurpose that energy and harness it for good.
Welcome to Top Docs. I'm Mike Merrill. You just heard from Laura Morton discussing Anxious Nation, a film she co-directed with Vanessa Roth, both of whom I speak with today. Laura has co-authored 40 books, 20 of which have appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. On these books, she has worked with everyone from Susan Lucci to Jennifer Hudson, Al Roker, and Justin Bieber, and many, many others. Vanessa is a veteran documentary filmmaker and won the Academy Award for her 2008 short, Freeheld. Both Laura and Vanessa have had personal experience with the main subject of this film, anxiety amongst children and teens, and they bring that experience to bear well, I think, here in the exploration of the lives of those who suffer from this reality, both the children as well as the parents. And they do a good job as well, I believe, in charting the rise of anxiety amongst our youth and explaining the cause of that rise and in sketching some of the steps, none of which are a magic bullet, that kids and parents might take to alleviate these issues. As some who listen to this pod regularly may remember, I too have experience with mental health issues. As always, I encourage everyone to seek out help early for you or for loved ones when such problems arise. Don't wait. Mental health challenges usually don't get better on their own and can often get much worse if left untreated. I'd recommend the Anxious Nation website if the stories you hear from Vanessa and Laura strike a chord with you. AnxiousNation.com, one word, AnxiousNation.com. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do follow the pod, and you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at TopDogsPod. Now, my conversation with Laura Morton and Vanessa Roth about their film, Anxious Nation. Laura and Vanessa, welcome to Top Docs.
Thank you so much for having us.
Laura, you know, I think we get a sense in the opening moments why you might be interested in this topic. You share with us your daughter's struggles with anxieties, but why did you want to make a documentary?
You know, I'm a storyteller by trade, Michael. I'm an author and I write a nonfiction, so I tell real life stories. I was sitting at my desk one day and I was feeling really defeated as a parent. And like what was happening in our home was only happening in our home. And this was in 2018, pre-COVID and where we are today, right? I just felt like I was failing miserably. So I put a post on Facebook, just one line, kids and anxiety, who's dealing with it? And I was super blown away by the response that I got. On Facebook, the response was pretty vanilla, if you will. But the private messages that I started to get came from people that I knew and knew well, people that I had just had dinner with, and we had never talked about the fact that their child had attempted suicide. We just never talked about it. And as a storyteller, I pushed back and thought, if my family is struggling and these families are struggling, I was really curious to know how other families were getting through it. I wanted to understand what's happening. Why are we in crisis? What's causing it? And most importantly, what can we do about it? I felt like it was more than a book. And I felt like to capture all of the stories the way that we did required that movement, that emotion, that real-time experience of what anxiety looks and feels like. So I set out to make a movie, something I'd never really done before.
And then, Vanessa, how did you become involved?
Yeah, my story, it's like an ebb and flow of involvement because Laura came to me really at the beginning of her thinking that she wanted to do this and she wanted to collaborate with someone who had done films before. And I have a background in social work and working with kids and families around mental health. And then I've also been doing docs for a long time. So she had come to me and my first response was, sounds great. Good luck. Let me know how it goes, because for me at that time, I had two teenagers and a little kid at home, and my teenagers were both, one of them had grown up with severe anxiety since she was 3 years old, or I think even before that, I noticed it in her. And then the other one was dealing with a lot of depression in high school. And I just felt like it was too close to home for me. I couldn't have my work be about the same thing I was trying to just sort of wade through at home. So Laura went off and she was determined to make this film and went and shot and got all these incredible lived experiences of kids and teenagers and families, came back to me with a cut of the film. And I asked if I could be part of finding the right structure for it and finding the pieces of it that would be more than just the collection of things that she had and to make it into a film. So we started working together. And again, I still was like, I'm not fully doing this. I'm just going to help you restructure things and try to find sort of a narrative arc to this. And I just really got sucked into the stories and our process together and brought on, you know, an editor and brought into this, the animation that we have in it, and just really loved then structuring it. Because at that point, when I got involved, I also felt like she's going to make this film and this film is important to come out into the world. And it's important for kids and families to have a resource like this. And I just felt like even if it was close to home, I actually needed it. And I really appreciated the other stories at this point, appreciated the experts. Maybe it was just as much of my own like therapy as it was making it for others.
I think much of the power of the film lies in these particular personal stories from children, adolescents, and the parents. But you do early on state like the bigger kind of thesis, which is basically 3 decades ago, the biggest problems facing children, teenagers were binge drinking, drunken driving, teenage pregnancy, smoking. I remember this. I live this. But today, a lot of that has gotten much, much better. But as these have fallen sharply, it's been replaced by soaring rates of mental health disorders.
One of the questions that I set out to answer when we started this process was, are we more anxious or are we just more aware of it? Because in 2018, 2019, that was a really relevant and pertinent question, right? In 2023, going into 2024, it's moot. I think we can, without any question, state that we are more anxious. And all of us are more anxious, but our kids are especially anxious as our seniors, right? What I think we've seen, we don't know. We're starting to see some of the fallout, if you will, from COVID and lockdown. We don't know the long-term stats yet. So most of the stats that we have are going into 2020, coming out of 2020. They got significantly worse. The CDC says when it comes to our kids, 3 out of 5, which is 57% of U.S. girls feel persistently sad and hopeless. And that's a 60% increase over the highest level ever reported. And 100% of all teens feel and report increasing mental health issues and challenges. Nearly 1 in 3 considered attempting suicide in 2021. These stats are frightening and they're getting worse. They're not getting better. There were a lot of let's talk about it campaigns that were in place, which were really, really good. But what it created was this tremendous demand, right? And we simply don't have the infrastructure to meet the demand that we now have in this country when it comes to mental health. There aren't enough people in the field to meet with everybody who has needs. But that's especially true for our youth. If you're a parent and you've ever tried to get your kid in to see somebody, the wait time could be 6 months. For me, I think that when those stats were get progressively worse as we were making the film, it made the film even more critical. If we saw a 51% comorbidity rate in any disease, we'd be ringing alarms. And we have a 51% increase in attempted suicides and hospital visits and suicides in this country, especially among young girls, which is incredible.
Yeah, and let's talk more about that as we go along in terms of the accelerating factors here. But let's move way, way back. And I think one of the things you do well in the film is you problematize a little bit that I think people get very into this nature versus nurture kind of simple explanation. And you have Lynn Lyon saying, hey, it's both, but it's even more than that. So let's go way, way back. Let's start with our evolutionary heritage, because I think Dan Siegel, who's a professor at UCLA and the head of the Mindset Institute, points out, hey, we're mammals. And so we have amygdala. We are very fragile creatures out there in the world. Why is that important to understanding anxiety?
We are prone to anxiety, just as we have all kinds of pieces of our psychology and our emotional state. And some people are more sensitive than others. Again, this does go to your nurture nature kind of conversation. But I think that we are all unique beings, and the way that our systems operate are unique to ourselves. And also, like you're saying, as a mammal, anxiety is part of that. It's there to protect us. It's there to help us when again, there are fear triggers. There are triggers that are natural, that are normal, that are all part of being human. And I think what the nurture nature part gets into is just, again, some of us are born more sensitive to our environment than other people. People sometimes obviously have gone through trauma, have experienced things that heighten their anxiety. And so what I love about the Lynn Lyons line is when she says, it's both. It's how do you nurture through that nature that's important. And I really think about that a lot, because I don't think it even just on the level of how do you as a parent nurture through the nature, but how do we as a society nurture through the nature? I don't think the society does a very good job nurturing our kids through their nature. What Laura is saying is that we don't really have the resources to really put into the needs that kids have, to give them the tools and the resources to cope with the ever-expanding stimulus that they have, information that they have, pressures that they have, just the world in general. We haven't focused a lot on that for kids.
Yeah. And it, you know, as far as this mammalian part of us goes, it really increases as we kick into adolescence, right? Because of the drive for affiliation, the drive for status, all these accentuated. One of the things I want to ask you just quickly about is one of the pools of outside kind of visuals you use is these early cartoons, mostly in black and white, Max Fleischer, early Disney. And I thought these were really interesting in this particular point, because I think one of the powers of seeing these early characters is that they are kind of these archetypal little mammals who are experiencing things we experience in a stripped down elemental way. Can you talk about using that material as you did?
Yeah, I love that you're bringing that out, because once we decided to bring in these early cartoons, I think what it did was, like you're saying, not that any of those cartoons were actually made to be about somebody having a panic attack or anxiety, but I found that actually all of them, when put into the context of what our kids were talking about, it actually worked out like perfectly. And it also, it sort of lightened our storytelling a little bit and makes things feel a little bit more relatable. And I think for us, we just needed to make it so that the film was something that anxiety can be talked about. It can be looked at just in a different way, because for kids and teenagers, what I thought was great was that it felt like this is kind of what's going on in their head about things. If they were to describe something, there's one that I love that Laura actually brought this cartoon into it, where I think it's Lynn Lyons talking about when anxiety becomes like a cult leader, your world shrinks so much and everyone starts following that person, the anxiety of the person, because you just want to survive. You just want to get through the day. And the cartoon that's used is this sort of mouse leading this marching band of all these other mice following him into a ditch. And then we tried to also use some just old sort of ephemeral stuff and some old film strip things, where my other favorite one is when, again, Lynn Lyons is talking about how as a parent, you're trying to think ahead about all the anxiety that's going to happen because your day just gets ruined if anxiety causes a panic attack and your kid can't go to school and everything kind of shuts down. And so you and the school come up with a plan and you make a whole plan for how the day is going to go perfectly as planned. And we use a moment of, you know, an old film of like a football coach showing, you know, where the quarterback's going to go. Someone's going to go to the left and someone's going to go to the right and all this. And so we just felt like it just adds a little bit of lightness to a topic that is obviously difficult to talk about and watch.
Absolutely. I think also on the nature side, one thing you point out is that some people are just more naturally anxious than others. And not surprisingly, given this is genetic, often they have a parent or parents who experience anxiety as well. And this is one of the things I think is really very well done in the film and would have been harder to do, I think, in a book, for example, Laura, because you can actually see this interaction between the parents and the child. Cooper and her mom, I think, are really kind of fascinating example of this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to Jackie numerous times as Cooper's mom, and I said, look, when we were filming that scene, I kept trying to divert her, right? Because I just knew how it looked. So I went to Jackie numerous times, and I said, look, there's this scene in the film. You know, I'm not out to make you the most hated mother in America. I think it's really important that if this is somehow going to hurt you, we don't need to keep the scene in the film. And I give her remarkable respect for saying to me, look, I know who I am as mother. I'm not perfect. And I'm not the only parent who does this. And if seeing that interaction helps other parents identify it, then I say, let it fly, let it live. It's a scene where Jackie, the mother, is talking to her daughter, Cooper, and, you know, kind of railing on her for not doing well in these auditions. And the mother was saying, if I were doing these auditions, I'd be nailing every single one of them. I don't understand what's so hard. Why is it so hard? We've seen this scene 1,000 times in our daily lives, right? We go to our kids' little league game and we see the dad on the sideline or the soccer field or the tennis court or you name it. We have parents who put that kind of pressure on their children to excel academically. You have to get straight A's. You have to go to an Ivy League school. I went to an Ivy League school. You have to go to an Ivy, you know, whatever it is. We've seen this scene played 1,000 times. And to me, I think it's one of the scenes that when families watch this, two things happen. One, one of the parents thinks, oh my God, is that me? Do I do that? And it also creates a really dynamic conversation after the film. And that's what we really wanted. We wanted to provoke a response that gets you to talk about and examine what is our role as parents in contributing to our kids' anxiety, even when we think it's coming from a place of love. If you really listen to that scene, Michael, what it's saying is, if I could go back in time and do it all over, this is what I would do. And if I could give you this information so that, you know, but it doesn't come off that way. So it was well-intended. And I think as parents, we come from a place of love and we come from a place of good intention. And we don't always nail it. And that's okay. The goal here is not to be perfect parents. The goal is to do better.
Yeah. And be awakened, I think, as one of your experts says. So I want to talk about the accommodation versus tough love thing in a second. But before we do that, one of the other things I think you explained is that often nervous parents do or anxious parents do, instead of providing general rules for the world, they provide very specific imagery. And this is something I really related to because in struggling with my fair-haired children in the California sun, I'm always trying to get them to put on lotion. And I've turned to like providing very specific imagery of what might occur to them at my age if they don't. And this can actually, surprisingly to me, maybe a little bit lead to deep anxiety, right? Instead of saying, put on your helmet, you explain, if you don't, you're going to fall and break your head. Can you talk about how that can backfire?
Yeah. Well, I mean, sort of like you started bringing up, it's that catastrophic thinking that then your child is living with this, just they're always having to think like 10 steps ahead of what's going to happen. What if, what if, what if, what if, instead of just realizing, okay, well, if something happens, we're going to deal with that then. We're going to cope with that at that point. But instead, yeah, like you're being well-meaning by saying you really need to put sunscreen on because I do know what's going to happen. Instead, they can't really see that, and that's like too far ahead in the future to really understand or do anything about, when actually it could be just as useful to just say, you know, it's good to put this on, or like you said, you should just wear a helmet, it's good, instead of, again, that catastrophic thinking. I think then just gets your kid's mind thinking ahead in a way that just, it's that fear-based model, which you don't even mean to be doing. But then they live in fear instead of trusting sort of their instincts and trusting their ability to work themselves through things that will happen, because there are going to be things that happen in life that are scary. There are going to be things that happen that aren't safe. There are going to be things that happen that are accidents. Again, to me, the film is really about how do you take all that uncertainty and figure out a way to manage.
And Lynn Lyons, who's just great here, she's just super smart about this. And I think it doesn't hurt that she's got this kind of muted Boston accent. Makes it feel like she's just delivering you the truth. You know, she paints a picture of two approaches that people often take that don't necessarily work, which is accommodation and tough love. And you focus more on the accommodation part, which I think makes sense because I think that our current parenting tends to be that direction, maybe a little overly solicitous of our children. She has this wonderful metaphor of what happens when you're overly accommodating of a child who's suffering anxiety, which is the cult leader, which you brought up before. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I think that's just a great metaphor and so helpful in understanding what happens here.
So what was amazing when I did all the interviews for this film, you know, there was a selfless piece and a selfish piece, right? With each and every interview, I got so much information for myself as a parent. And when I heard Lynn talk about two things, one, the cult leader in the home and then doing the disorder, because they really go together, right? That was so unforgettable to me because I didn't realize that I had actually invited the cult leader into our home. What she talks about is that anxiety is like a cult leader in your home. Just like being in a cult, if you're doing what the cult leader wants, everything is great. The second you start turning against the cult leader, the second you start doing things the cult leader doesn't want you to do, then that's where the problems come in. That's where the problems creep in. In my family, that meant something like allowing my daughter to sleep in my bed all the time. When she went to bed, I went to bed. She always had to know where we were going, who was going to be there. Do they have long hair or short? She needed all the details. Anything in the unknown was unacceptable to her. And I was always feeding it. I was always saying, well, this is what we're going to do. And you need to go to bed, so I'll go to bed. And right down to tying her shoes when she was certainly old enough to do it, cutting her meat when she was old enough to do it. These were things that not only were inviting the cult leader, because it kept, my daughter's name is Sevi. If Sevi wanted pizza for dinner and I wanted Chinese, we were absolutely having pizza because of the struggle that would have happened. And I think parents don't even realize that we do it. But at the end of the day, as parents, we're tired and we've already had a stressful day. And now we just, all we want to do is shut things down. Let's get this kid into bed. And I need to breathe a little bit. So we take the path of least resistance. And that is the culmination of the cult leader having control over what happens in the home, how it happens, when it happens, and our actions of doing the disorder, meaning accommodating all of those actions. It was really eye-opening for me because it never occurred to me that what I was doing was creating a bigger problem.
Yeah, you're feeding the beast there. And the other approach is the tough love approach. Just briefly on this, you know, obviously, if your child doesn't feel you support them, that's not a great place for them to be either. You discuss how sometimes in the family, what happens is one parent starts really embracing the accommodationist approach and one tough love approach, and they just pull further and further apart, right? Neither one of them's helping out the situation. But Lynn Lyons talks instead rather about building skills. Can you talk about what she means by this? What sorts of skills does she mean here?
I feel like there's this delicate balance and dance all the time as a parent, because yes, you don't want to necessarily fall into this cult leader doing the disorder. But on the other side, too, you do want to be able to acknowledge that your child is actually going through what they're going through and not be, I think sometimes too, as parents, or I know for myself, we get so afraid of ourselves not having tools and we don't really know what to do. So when we don't know what to do, we either try to step in and solve it for them, or on the other side, if you're more of the tough love, it's because you don't know what to do. So you start just like shutting that down, saying, you don't feel that way, get over it, move on. Again, the accommodating ones, like, I don't know, I can't fix this. So I'm scared because I can't fix this. And I want to be the parent that can fix everything. One of the things that I think the film gets into, and we try to really amplify the kids' voices about this for themselves, is that tools like even just like mindfulness, like learning how to take a minute, learning to just accept your feelings about things, learning really like acceptance of, this is how I'm feeling right now. This isn't going to last forever. And giving kids agency over their own experiences. And I think that's what, when Lynn talks about those skills, it's realizing the anxiety is happening. Okay, yes, I'm feeling this way. This is really scary. And then thinking, okay, again, this is going to pass. It's not going to last forever. And then there are some, again, different things that the kids in the film actually talk about, what they've done on a bigger scale, like find meaning, find purpose, find community. Yeah. These are bigger things. Not be isolated. Find things that you like to do. There are those things. But I think in the moment, Liz Lyons talks about just when you do start spiraling into more of a panic attack, how to be able to center yourself. And that's something only the kid or teenager can do for themselves, really. Like, we can try to be useful and helpful and hold their hand and walk alongside them, but they're going to have to figure that out as they get older, too.
There's a number of things that are there that I think also could work for adults, by the way, too.
Or just
learning how to sit in this anxiety. One of the suggestions Lynn has is calling it Fred. The distinguishing between the experience of anxiety and yourself is a very powerful tool that mindfulness teaches, right? And realizing also perspective. You're going to suffer some disappointment. There is going to be stress in your life. Learn to sit in it. Learn it's not going to kill you. And very importantly, I think, and a number of your people point this out, is it's not the actual stress or anxiety in the moment that's the worst part. It's what you do with it. It's what Buddhism has called the second dart. How do you respond to it? How do you take it? What do you do with it?
I wanted to add one more thing to that, because I think it's really important to know that when you have an anxious child, if you just treat the child and you have parents that are contributing to that child's anxiety and they're not changing their behavior, they're not changing their response, their reaction, the cards are really stacked against that child, because the same patterns in the home are happening. So I'm a big proponent, and I think it's really important to point out that part of giving that child tools is also giving parents tools and treating it systemically. So you have to be a part of that therapy. You have to be a part of that growth. And if you're not willing to look in the mirror, that's, or have the hard conversations, that will have an exponential impact. But I think it's so important that families understand. And it was one of my biggest ahas, was that what my child is feeling is real to her. Even if it seems utterly ridiculous to me. It's real to her. And that was a really big aha for me. It sounds so simple. And it sounds like, how could I have not known that? But at the end of the day, as parents, we want our kids to have resilience. We want them to have the tools, and we keep putting the tools in the toolbox. If your child's not using it, there's a reason why. So we have to look at that and understand that what they feel, they may not even be able to articulate. They may not even be able to understand, but it's happening and it's manifesting and it's showing itself. And we have to be able to take a step back and go, okay, this is something else, right? It took 7 years for somebody to tell me my daughter had anxiety, because every doctor I took her to said it was something physical, not something emotional. And when parents are getting that kind of advice from medical professionals, that's where they go, then it must be her diet. It must be that she's not getting enough fiber, or maybe she has a dairy allergy, or maybe, you know, 1,000 things. Maybe she has ADD or ADHD. Or 7 years for a doctor to say, your daughter has anxiety, right? And I took her to therapists who didn't tell me. It's a process, and an important process to be a part of as a family, because it oftentimes in families, there are kids that also are more anxious than their siblings, and they tend to be the ones where the center of attention is in the home all the time. And that's really important to understand the impact on the rest of the family.
You spoke a little bit about this, but I'd like to explore a little bit more is acceleration of anxiety, acceleration of things like self-harm in particular seems to be on the rise. And there's a lot of possible things to point to, but one that I think you note and has been noted by a number of people is social media, the way it's basically permeates young people's lives. Can you talk about why that might be exacerbating the problem?
I think it's a combination of so many things, right? There's the body image, your identity, you're being judged every second of everything you do and you're posting online. And again, the task of a teenager is to grow into their own self. But in that moment, it's one of the experts also talks about, again, back to your sort of mammal thing of you need to be accepted by a group or else you're going to be somebody's lunch is what they say. So you need to be accepted. You want to be part of something. I think it's Dan Siegel who talks about this and says, so when your kid that says that they need that new pair of boots or that new jacket, it's not them just saying that they need all these things, but it's more that they need to fit in because they need to be part of something, because that's what's going on developmentally for them. And that's exactly the time when we're introducing them to social media, where their peer group now becomes the whole world. So now they need to be accepted by everyone in the whole world. So there's that piece of it. I have a 12-year-old, and I think that they're pretty social media literate, and they don't seem to be falling so much into a FOMO kind of thing or like that, but just this constant stimulation of what's coming into them to have to process, I see as something that I just notice the difference between if we've done something that's not social media versus time when they're on social media. It's just even, I don't know, this buzz, I feel like it goes around of literally like just like too much information going on. And then the other piece of it that we talk about in the film that the kids talk about is this social isolation, that while they think it's these connections, it's actually not connected and you actually feel less connected. And I think a lot of the focus ends up being on that feeling of like, oh, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. But I think there's actually even more to it than just that, with just, again, the amount of stuff that's coming in and how to process all of that as well.
I think it's really important to note that I don't think all of social media is bad. I actually think there are some really good things that come out of social media. If it weren't for Snapchat, my daughter would never have any connection with her friends. But what I think we have to address is, and we do it in the film, and every statistic that we use in the film came from an internal study at Meta. And what we have to address is that these companies, these tech companies, these platforms know what they're doing. As it's intentional. And the algorithms are designed to suck our kids in. They're designed to suck us in. I think that's where the breaking point is. I think if you know that you're doing damage, then I think we have to hold those companies accountable to do better. I think that they've taken some steps. I don't think they've taken all the steps that need to take place. They're protected under the Communications Safety Act, that they have no culpability for third-party postings, so that you have situations that become breeding grounds. But I think that the Section 230 is a law that if Trump and Obama had anything in common, it was that they both tried to overturn Section 230, which meant that they no longer would allow these tech companies to self-regulate. We don't allow big pharma to self-regulate. We don't allow tobacco companies to self-regulate, but we do allow big tech to self-regulate. And there's a reason for that. So I think what we have to do then is hold them to a higher standard. in terms of what they know that they're doing and the damage that they're doing specifically to our kids by design.
And there are real challenges that young people face today. COVID was this huge thing, both isolating and actually, while young people are less likely to die, they could see their relatives were in danger, and Black and brown kids face all sorts of challenges, obviously even deeper set of challenges. And of course, global warming is real. And my kids talk about that, the fear of what will be like to live in this world in 30 years or 50 years from now. Let me ask this, Vanessa, you touched on it a little bit, but there are a number of different strategies, obviously going and seeing a professional. Don't wait, Pete, folks. Do understand that these things are not necessarily permanent, that there are things that can be done. Please do, if you have a child, you have the ability to go to seek professional help. You talk a bit about exercise, pets, music, spirituality, all these things as potentially ways of dealing with stress. But there's one big one I think is really important, which is that one of the best bets in the long term is being less self-focused, of seeking something bigger than yourself, of being of service, of chasing meaning rather than comfort. Can you talk about that? Because I think that's not obvious sometimes.
I think what we know is that our kids in particular have a spiritual hunger, but they've utterly rejected their parents' religion. And for thousands of years, that connection, that spiritual connection is what brought us together. I think what's happened now is we have kids that are trying to find connection in other ways, whether it's meditation, doing yoga, studying Buddhism, whatever it is, they want to connect to something. And I think that's so important that we recognize that there are many ways to get there. There's one young lady in the film who reconnected with her relationship with God. There are other kids in the film who find it through music, through dance, through performance, through acting, whatever it is. What we now know is that anxiety is an energy. And that energy can be repurposed, and it can be repurposed for good. And we see this all the time with celebrities and how they talk about their anxieties, and yet you would never know it because they use it in their performance. Athletes, you know, elite athletes use it in their performance. But that need to connect, if we have a crisis of anxiety in this country, we have an even bigger crisis of loneliness and disconnection in this country. And that really needs to be addressed. And I think to some degree, that's probably the biggest hurdle we have to figure out. How do we come back together in this divisive world that we're living in and is getting wider and wider, right? That division. How can we come back together? And one of the reasons why we named the film Anxious Nation was because even if we unite through our anxiety, through something so that we don't feel alone, so that we feel seen and heard, and we feel acknowledged, then we're connecting. We're bringing people back together.
I just, again, see it in my own kids and just in my own self, that anxiety becomes like this when you're feeling it really, it's very present for you. It becomes like this compulsion, right? It just keeps like spiraling in your head and you're just thinking of your own self and how am I going to do this? And I can't, you know, it's that thing of we all, maybe all experience like in the middle of the night, you know, when you wake up and you have that, like all the bad things in your mind. And for a kid who's, again, like alone in their room or just on, whether it's social media or just by themselves and isolated in that way, or just really just thinking about yourself. Again, now I have two of my kids are in their 20s. And I just noticed too, the more you sit and churn away at that, the more of, again, of a spiral it gets to be. And so even just literally just the act of going outside yourself to do something, like one of my daughters is now a teacher and a chef, the other one's a songwriter, when they're both being productive in something and just again living towards some other thing that's just not in their head, things start feeling better. And then that has this domino effect of then you're connected to other people and you're communicating and you're expressing yourself. And suddenly, like Laura said, then there's not that loneliness. And then you actually could focus on someone else and not just internally suffering. And then there's the bigger thing of if you actually participate in things that do give you meaning and purpose, you can see yourself as a piece of this bigger picture. Some of the experts talk about this in the film too. You just get out of your head again as there's so much pressure being on you because you become part of something that's bigger than yourself, whatever that bigger than yourself thing is. And I do find of all the things that I've watched my own kids go through and just in my own personal experience too, again, like you said, therapy can help, getting different tools can help in the moment, but really on a bigger level, it really feels like the more you can find things, again, that give you a feeling of purpose and meaning and be engaged in the world, whatever that means to you, is a really, like you said, a more long-term kind of solution.
That's a great reminder. And by the way, I really appreciate both what you folks have done here and all the people involved, the parents and the kids. talking about this, because I think a bigger point here behind this movie is to also deal with the stigma of mental health. People aren't talking about this. It takes 2 to 8 years, one of your experts says, for most parents to reach out. We deal with a rash immediately. If we get a rash on our skin, we deal with it immediately. But when we see our child suffer, we wait. And I think this is part of the stigma. And I've alluded to my own challenges on the pod. And I really appreciate you folks beginning to take down some of that stigma around discussing these things, which is so crucial for anxiety and for all these other mental health challenges we have in our world today.
Thank you for saying that, because that really is why we made the film. You know, I tell people all the time, you don't make documentaries to make money. You want to make an impact. And I think that we are making an impact. Every time somebody watches this film, I know that it has a good impact on their lives. Like, it gives them a lot to think about, talk about. We've had adults watch this film who never recognized that they grew up anxious and are still anxious.
Yep.
We talk a lot about the kids in this film, but really, I think anybody who watches this film will just automatically relate it to whatever their own experiences are. And we left a lot open to your interpretation by design. And that is the brilliance. And Vanessa, I say this all the time, but Vanessa is a brilliant storyteller and filmmaker. And without Vanessa, I would not have the film that we have to bring into the world. And I'm so grateful for the fact that ultimately she did say yes. I was very persistent, but I'm very grateful that she did say yes, because it was a difference maker in having, I think, two moms who have anxious kids be the storytellers.
I appreciate that you decided to talk about this film. I think, like you just, what you were saying too, just about your own experience, all of our own experiences with our own mental health and our kids' mental health. I think, like you said, just the talking about it might not make you feel better in yourself that day, but I think it lifts a little bit to feel like you're not just so much going through this alone. I think, again, why Laura made this was thinking she was kind of alone and was experiencing the worst thing that any family's ever experienced. And just to talk about it just lifts it, like, okay, yeah, so what? So you have anxiety and you can't go out today. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you so much, folks. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Do you have a hidden gem, like a documentary that you don't think gets the attention it deserves?
The short film I saw, and I feel like probably just as so many shorts and even feature docs can get lost in the shuffle of everything. I don't know how people would see it, but it's a film called Acuarente. It's a short doc by a Spanish filmmaker named Manuel Munoz Rivas. I just found it is so poetic. It's about this ferry ride from one place to another. You don't really even know where it is. And it's this mythical kind of just poetic, just really not even a narrative to it. It's just really so beautiful of just humans on this ferry. And it just, to me, spoke to the potential of filmmaking and documentary storytelling and capturing the essence of just what it is to be alive. It's a short, maybe it's 20 minutes or something, but I just found it so beautiful.
I was amazed. This was my first time going through the film festival circuit. And what I was amazed at was how much good content there was that would never see the light of day. Vanessa and I were in Palm Springs together and we met Ross Kaufman. He did a film last year called Of Medicine and Miracles. That film really touched me. I was really blown away by it. It chronicles the monumental task of curing cancer, and it follows the story of a young girl who has leukemia and her battle. It also follows the story of this doctor, Dr. June, who was just relentless in his efforts with targeted therapy, immunotherapy. I was very moved by the film. I'm a breast cancer survivor, so it spoke to me on many levels. But as a parent, watching this family go through what they went through with their child, so heartbreaking and incredible. And it's actually a happy ending, which is nice to see. So I really love that movie.
Top Docs is a production of Woolly Media. This episode was produced by Ken Jacobson and Mike Merrill, and edited by Mike.